taste of our new album, Dr. Feelgood, before it's out in the stores?
Yeah!
Enter the crew contest.
Yeah!
If you have a touchtone phone, call us on the Motley Crew hotline. 1-900-932-8-CREW.
This album has a lot of depth to it. How long did you guys work on it? It sounds like you spent a long time working on this record.
Yeah, we worked on the songs of, God, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 months. I mean, we wrote like 30 songs for the album, and we'd tear them apart, go in, demo up some of them, cancel some of them, rewrite some, you know, and then we picked our favorite 15 songs and went to Vancouver and recorded.
Now, you recorded with Bob Rock, who is one of the finest rock and roll producers out there right now. I heard you sent tapes to 10 guys, and he got the job. What swung it toward him? Why'd you decide to go with him?
We've loved some of the stuff that he's done in the past. He's worked with a lot of people. He always got great monster guitar and drum sounds, and his vocal sounds are great. He's also an engineer. That's how we got his start, was being an engineer. And he writes songs, he produces. He's like your all-in-one dude that just knows how to do it all. He's
a rocker too.
Yeah,
you know, he's young, he's got long hair, you know, and he's a surfer guy, you know. Yeah. Just like
so he's one of us then.
He's one of those guys. Exactly. He can stay. We like him.
You're in, Bob.
First song we're going to play tonight is Dr. Feelgood. There are a lot of Dr. Feelgoods in the world right now. Now, this drug dealer in your song looks like he's about to take the big fall, doesn't he?
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, you're gone.
Dr. Feelgood, Motley Crue, Rockline.
Hi, I'm Kurt Loder. Welcome to The Week in Rock. The most momentous story of the week concerns Guns N' Roses frontman Axl Rose, who's very preoccupied trying to finish off the group's long-delayed new albums for an August 27th release, and Motley Crue singer Vince Neil, who wants Rose to drop everything and duke it out with him in a boxing match. There's been bad blood between these two bands for at least the last 3 years, ever since Guns guitarist Izzy Stradlin reportedly put some rude moves on Neil's wife, the former exotic performer Cherise, at a Los Angeles rock club called The Cat House. Several months later, when Stradlin and Rose made an appearance at the MTV Video Music Awards show, Neil was lying in wait when they came off stage and hit Stradlin with a sucker punch. Then, in an interview with MTV News that aired last September, Rose had this to say about Neil.
It's funny because Izzy's like going, because people think it's going to happen sooner or later or whatever, and it's like that Vince and I are getting into it or something, you know, and Izzy laughs because he's like, that guy, you know, had a full-on free shot, you know, and hit like a powder puff, you know, and he's like, so it's like, it's pretty scary if a guy thinks about a real hassle, you know. I put in a magazine, you know, anytime he wants it, anywhere, Atlantic City, I don't care, we'll put money on it, you know. I don't care, you know, and then we try to turn it around and say the same thing, but, you know, the invitation's there, I'm easy to find.
After mulling that over for, almost a year, Vince Neil, who's reportedly just separated from his wife Cherie, sat down with MTV News this week and issued this challenge.
He said a lot of bad things about me the last few years, and a lot of threats, and even on, I remember one of your guys' shows before the MTV Awards, and where he said, well, anytime, any place, and right now, I want to put an end to this, and what I want is, Axl, if you're watching this, I want to challenge you to a fight. I'm going to give you the time, and I'm going to give you the place, and there's no backing out now, buddy, and it's time to put up or shut up. I'd like to do it at an arena where people can come and see. I'd like to have it televised. I want the whole world to see this fight. And I think it'll be great. I'm really psyched for it. Because I need to put an end to this, so there's no more. I mean, it'll end it once and for all in bad blood between us.
Hello, you're listening to Rock and or Roll. I'm BJ, and this is, oh God, what number is this? Episode number 5 in the Motley Crue series. Dr. Feelgood, is this their fifth album? For this episode, I'm joined by, from the Decibel Geek podcast, Chris Sinzak and Aaron Camaro. Hey, guys.
Hey.
What's up, BJ?
How's it going?
Oh, it's going awesome, man. I'm excited for today. This is like it's like junior high all over again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this was this when this album came out, I was fully immersed in everything that had to do with this kind of music. And Headbangers Ball and Metal Edge magazine, and that was my whole life practically at this point. So,
but it was everything. It was everywhere. It was this was the time when it was actually cool to like Motley Crue because everybody liked Motley Crue.
Yeah, this was their biggest album. They were ubiquitous at this point.
Yeah, I remember this era because just like you guys, I was fully immersed in all this stuff. I was buying albums like it was going out of style, mm-hmm. and before it was going out of style. Yeah, Motley Crue, I could honestly say for a little while there, at least during this time, I think they were the biggest band in rock, and they even transcended that somewhat with, they even broke into the mainstream. There were people that were just pop fans that would buy this record.
Right, yeah. I mean, from dating famous actresses to, mm-hmm. you know, being on TV and the stories that you heard about them, it was cool because this was back when a rock band could be considered dangerous, you know, and this was the kind of band your parents didn't want you to listen to. But it was at a time where they became so popular that, like I said, everybody was listening to them. There was the hot girls that I went to school with all wearing Motley Crue t-shirts and their cut up jeans and all that stuff, man. Why can't we go back to that?
Because Vince Neil doesn't look anything like that anymore.
Oh, yeah. Me neither.
Yeah, just looking at all the albums that were coming out, like in between Girls, 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 and then around the time of Dr. Feelgood, it was just, you know, there was so much. So everything like Winger and Warrant and everything was all huge at the same time, too. So, you know, it was just primed and ready for a Motley Crue album, which this is the Motley Crue album that really was like the hair metal version of Motley Crue too, a lot of this. So it's
totally, yeah.
So they just fit right into what a lot of bands that were inspired by them and came after them, but you know, were really successful right at this time period. The Motley Crue went from the early 80s metal, you know, they went on and had their biggest success in the hair metal era, where the other bands like Rat and, you know, Quiet Riot and Dokken, and they all kind of fell off when those other bands, you know, took over all the popularity. But Motley Crue managed to, you know, break through. And I mean, listening to this album, you hear the Poison. You could hear some of the Poison influence on this, I swear. Like they really kind of adapted. I guess they always did that though through their career, just like adapted to the time. But they did it in a more subtle way than Kiss. You know, Kiss were so overt and obvious about when they were adapting to what was popular, but Motley Crue just kind of managed to do it, but not as obvious, you know.
And I think it's kind of like you say, you know, where the bands now are the bands that were influenced by Motley Crue. They were the kids that were seeing the Crue play on the Sunset Strip that said, "We got to do that," you know, and came up the next round of bands, you know, the second wave of this. And this is at that time. And like you said, some of those bands are kind of going away. But Motley Crue, I think maybe because they kind of teased it a little bit with Theater of Pain, mm-hmm. that eased right into this and did it better than most of the bands that were coming out doing this.
Yeah. And Bob Rock really, you know, helped them to adapt their sound to, you know, what was big on the radio at that time. They really, it fit right in.
Well, and I think he kind of helped put them over the top because you know, the production on this just blows away Girls, Girls, Girls. And,
oh, sure.
And of course, Theater of Pain, like they had never had production on the level of what Bob Rock brought to the table. So you essentially had, you know, it's basically like Motley Crue on steroids with Nicky going even pushing harder into a pop sensibility with the songwriting. Cause you know, they had ballads on other records, but the hooks and stuff on this record, for good or for bad, and then Bob Rock's production, you know, it was one of those, it was kind of a can't miss thing because they were borrowing from Poison and bands like that a little bit on this, but I think they almost got a pass because it was like those bands wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Motley Crue starting what they did in the early 80s.
Right.
Whereas with Kiss, it was like, well, Kiss was a completely different band in the 70s. Mm-hmm. We're not going to give them a pass because they're trying to ape everything else that's out right now.
And it's obvious because it is such a big difference.
Right. Even though Crazy Nights is a great record. I'll just say.
But I'm not really, personally, I don't really understand what was so good about the song Dr. Feelgood that made that a top 10 hit besides just airplay, just tons of airplay on MTV and the radio.
Oh, I disagree.
I don't get it.
Love the song.
Oh, that's one of the best riffs to come out of the 80s.
And I remember seeing the video for the first time and being so excited and being in a room full of people, you know, that are the same age as me. They're just as excited to see this. You know, this was back in the day, you know, before you could get on the YouTube and watch 100 million different videos. You know, you had to be there at the right time, at the right place in front of MTV and catch that video or know it's coming up. And I'm sure that's what it was. Is, you know, coming up at 5 o'clock, we're going to play the new Motley
World premiere.
It was a big deal.
Yeah. So everybody gathered around and watched it, and it made it a community thing. And I think that's part of what made it so special. So when something is as just popular as that, you know, and the anticipation for the new crew coming out and Dr. Feelgood being such a kick-ass tune, you know, all together, it adds up and it makes it what it is.
And I know we're going to go track by track, but that to start off, I mean, obviously you have the TNT, the Terror in Tinseltown thing, which, yeah, it is what it is. It's not really a song, but when it kicks into Dr. Feelgood, I mean, and I will say, I am going to shit on some of the songs on this record, so prepare yourself. But this song delivers the goods in spades because it's, if I hear it even today, I'm like, that's a fucking great song because just the bottom end, that the crunch and everything that Bob Rock could bring to that sound with Nikki's bass line and stuff and Tommy's drumming and it's even got lyrics that are a little deeper than what a typical hair band would do. You know, it's songs about the drug trade in L.A. and all that. I think this song, that song stands out among a lot of the hair metal stuff where it's kind of like that song still sounds great today to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, they're singing about a drug dealer basically, but at this point they had all been together in like a drug treatment facility in Tucson and they were supposedly all clean and sober. You know, when they were in Vancouver recording this, what I read is they were next door to Aerosmith recording at the same studio, and they both had that guy, Bob Timmons, I think his name was, who was like, they had like, what are that? They had like that Metallica Saint Anger situation going on where they had this guy there with them to help them stay clean.
Aerosmith.
Yeah. Yeah. He was working with, they were doing Pump, and he's trying to keep Motley Crue and Aerosmith on the wagon at the same time.
Wow.
He deserves a medal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. But, but at the same time, that same, like month that they were in the treatment facility, that's when Doc McGee got arrested for smuggling 29,000 pounds of marijuana to North Carolina on a shrimp boat. And that was why the whole Moscow Music Peace Festival ends up happening. Later in our story, because he, part of his plea deal was he started the Make a Difference Foundation.
Yeah.
And did you know that that was his second drug trafficking bust? He had been busted for cocaine in Louisiana too.
Yeah.
Wow.
I gotta wonder though, because around that time, a shrimp boat and offloading drugs, I wonder if Forrest and Bubba had something to do with
it. Yeah.
You want a chocolate?
That's why you got caught. You hire Forrest Gump to smuggle your drugs? Yeah, so that's it's funny that the band's clean and their manager is a drug dealer. Is getting busted for dealing, for trafficking. But
it makes total sense though with Motley Crue.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those magical times.
Yeah. When they did the Moscow Music Peace Festival, there was like the joke because everybody was flying over to Russia and there was drugs and alcohol all over the plane. And like, they were making the joke that it was not the Make a Difference Foundation. It was the Make a Different Drink Foundation.
Yeah. 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 And then that's when they fired Doc McGee because he also managed Bon Jovi. And I mean, people are probably familiar with the story of the pyro, and they were pissed off because, you know, Motley Crue didn't want to be the opening band. Bon Jovi were headlining. But supposedly they weren't going to be able to put on a big show. But then as soon as the pyro goes off, Tommy Lee chases down Doc McGee and punches him in the face.
But I thought Doc got fired because he brought Nikki Sixx's mom to the hotel, remember? In the movie?
Yeah.
Sorry.
That was something that was all over MTV, when the Moscow Music Peace Festival happened. Remember how they were pushing Gorky Park at the time?
Bang!
Because they were the Russian band that opened the show. Yeah.
Triangle Guitar. Yeah, I remember that.
They also, I didn't know about this. I was just reading about that. They recorded a song called Powerful Stuff for the Cocktail soundtrack, that Tom Cruise movie. But they didn't like it. And then the Fabulous Thunderbirds ended up doing the same song.
Really?
Yeah.
I always learn so much from you.
It's I was looking up the people that wrote it, and they didn't really have any other songs they wrote that they weren't like hit makers or anything. It was just this. I mean, when you hear the song, you're like, I can understand why Motley Crue were like, yeah, we're not going to put that out.
Fabulous Thunderbirds did a Motley Crue song. That's weird.
What it says on Chronological Crew is that was kind of they were doing that with Tom Werman, and it was the session didn't go well, and they weren't happy with how it turned out, and that was kind of the end of their relationship with Tom Werman, was that session for that song. Yeah, supposedly then they were considering having Quincy Jones produce their next album when they fell out with Tom Werman.
Are you sure that they were clean during this time?
Yeah, well, supposedly they were. Yeah.
Oh, man. Wow. I just gave up the heroin and started doing acid.
It's as weird as when Priest wanted to work with those pop, electro pop songwriters in the 80s.
Weird. Yeah. I'm not sure. Do you guys know?
Came to be?
Well, it's even worse than that.
Do you guys know how they ended up getting linked up with Bob Rock?
No.
I don't.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, he had. Right before this, he had done Kingdom Come and Sonic Temple and Blue Murder. That's, he had been Bruce Fairbairn's engineer, I think, and had worked on Slippery When Wet and stuff, but he had started producing on his own then. And
those bands all have really great sounding albums, so you got to figure they probably heard the Kingdom Come and those other bands.
Yeah, I mean, if I heard Fire Woman, I would be like, get me that guy who produced that, because that fucking sounds great, you know?
Blue Murder album.
Or with the Slippery When Wet connection, possibly Doc may have had a say in that. I don't know, because of the Bon Jovi connection.
Yeah, but this is before Metallica, so, that was really when Bob Rock became,
I think this was the album that Lars used
Lars
as the blueprint for the Black album.
Yeah.
He said, that the same thing. Lars heard Dr. Feelgood and said, we want that guy.
He wanted that drum sound. I know that.
Yeah, so they ended up meeting up with Bob Rock and they hit it off, I guess. So they went to, and that was probably a good idea. They're trying to stay clean, so getting out of Hollywood, get out of LA, go record your album in Vancouver. You know, less temptation, probably, you know, get away from home and to help them to stay sober, which is supposedly, you know, what they were trying to do at this time. So honestly, I've never been a huge Motley Crue fan, more like certain songs. I love, you know, the first two albums, but I've been Debbie Downer on a lot of these Motley Crue episodes. So,
wow.
But yeah,
I love the crew.
I guess this is the time period where they got really into tattoos, right? Like where Nikki and Tammy are getting entire sleeves and everything. And so the Dr. Feelgood cover was actually designed by one of their tattoo artists, I guess.
I do love the cover. I mean, I think it's great. It's got the medical symbol with the snake and everything. And it's got, you know, the green tile in the background. I always thought it was a really cool cover.
I guess that's one of them things, you know, you're just replacing one addiction with another. You know, you're going from doing drugs and drinking all the time, and now all of a sudden it's like, I got to get out. Not one tattoo. I need all tattoos.
Right.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Yeah. Yeah, but so, like, you know, if you look at, like, on these previous episodes, there's so many stories of just ridiculous, outrageous behavior and debauchery on the previous tours, but if you look at the Dr. Feelgood tour, there's just none of that. So I guess they actually were, you know, on the wagon for this whole period. Right. Even going, like, all the way up to the 94 album, they were still basically, well, isn't that like when Tommy started getting the heroin, though, I think? But I don't know, I guess Nikki Sixx never really fell off the wagon hard after, you know, he cleaned up, did he?
I think he pretty much stayed on the straight and narrow, other than, you know, he's smoking weed and shit like that.
Yeah.
But I think he pretty much gave up the hard stuff around this time.
So it's funny that there aren't all those stories. There's so many ridiculous stories from their previous tours, but then you look at about this tour and there's just none of that. I mean, there's Vince Neil punching Izzy Stradlin out at the VMAs. And then there was that whole thing where Vince and Axl Rose were going to have a boxing match, like pay-per-view boxing match or something.
See, but again, this is the sign of the times. You know, Vince Neil and Axl Rose were our Kardashians.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Vince had married Charisse in this time period. And then the story was that Izzy Stradlin was hitting on her at a strip club or something, and then she told Vince about it, and then he punched Izzy at the VMAs, and then the feud, you know, shifted from Izzy to Axl, I guess, because Axl loved that kind of shit.
Right.
Get that in the ring, motherfucker, you know.
That whole rivalry was a lot of fun, though, because I remember when they were, you know, trading barbs back and forth in the Rock magazine and on MTV. I mean,
yeah.
Vince Neil, like, called Axl out on MTV.
Sure did.
And wanted to fight him.
Yeah, it was hilarious.
It was so funny, but I don't know. It was just rock music had kind of taken on a real bigness during this period of time where even people that were casual music fans really got into this stuff. And I remember a lot of people that, like I said earlier, they were just pop fans. They liked whatever was popular, and they went out and bought Dr. Feelgood. It was like this album permeated everything in my school. And I remember a lot of girls were really into Vince Neil at the time. Vince was a real sex symbol at this time, as funny as that is to say now. But he really was. I mean, they were everywhere. You could not escape Motley Crue around this period.
Yeah, I mean, the highest that Home Sweet Home got on the charts was 89, which I was really shocked by, because because it was on MTV so much and everything. But that's one where, you know, for years and years afterwards, they still played that video all the time, you know, and it just always stayed around. But, you know, on this record, they had two top 10 singles. They had never had those kind of hit songs until this record, which is why it was so, you know, so ubiquitous and just everywhere. I mean, they were so big that the record label gave them their own record label, Motley Records, and they signed this massive deal. I think it was like a $25 million deal, got their own label. They put out a best of collection that went platinum, which, you know, that was the the golden age of the record labels when they could just repackage the same songs and sell them a million more of them.
Was that Decade of Decadence?
Yeah, yeah. Of course, that, you know, had some new material.
Songs on there, so it was worth it.
Yeah, no, I love that album.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Primal Scream is one of their best songs, so they...
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, that was the time. You put out a greatest hits, put a couple new songs on there. Yeah. But that was that was released by their own label. But then, of course, the record industry completely changed after that, and so... That Motley $25 million deal, giving them their own label, the record company regretted that pretty fast.
Yeah, I'm sure they did.
Yeah.
Well, and again, too, you got to think about, you know, how you talk about that kind of money and that kind of deal. But look at Motley Crue, you know, for as successful as they've been for how many years leading up to this, this is their huge breakthrough album.
Oh, easily.
And they've already sold millions of albums, but this was the one that was so huge that it even eclipsed everything they'd done before it and took them into another place that I don't know too many rock bands that were as huge as Motley Crue before them.
Mm-mm. Yeah, and it seemed like it was going to last forever. Nobody thought in 1989, 1990 that, you know, this was the peak of this kind of music and that it was all just going to drop off a cliff.
Yeah.
It was just crazy when, I mean, you know, I always think about like the guys in Warrant, you know, they must have thought, holy shit, we're set for life. And then the next year they're just done. It's over.
Yeah. You know, it was brutal. Guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. They barely had time to enjoy the success.
I know. Yeah. It was crazy.
It's like little kids hanging out and looking at the stars, listening to Motley Crue, Dr. Feelgood on the boombox saying, we're going to live forever.
And then Eddie Vedder shows up and smacks you in the face.
he sure did.
Yeah, so like I was saying, on the previous episodes, to tell all these ridiculous stories of all the crazy shit they did on tour, but there's not a lot of that for this album.
I think the most ridiculous story I know from this era is stories of them while they're recording, jogging around the lake.
Yeah, right.
Wow. Wild times.
Wild times. I didn't catch the movie yet. Was that in there?
No. I think that was purposely left out. Oh, man.
Yeah, they really, when they got to the end of the movie, they really just tried to squeeze like 20 years into about 5 minutes. So they ran out of time.
I wasn't upset that they did that. Trust me. Yeah. It's not like, well, we don't really need to talk about the other 20. Although I not to delve into the movie too much, but I enjoyed the movie for what it was. It's basically, it's a junk food type movie, but it's fun. It reminds you of that era when they were on top and it, you know, references some of the funny stories from the book. I just, there's some people that I think are taking too deep of a dive into how accurate it had to be. It's just a goofy movie. But if they had really wanted to do it right, I think it would have been like, do like a mini series on Netflix. Do like, you know, 6 to 8 episodes where you dive in an hour deep each time. And it would have been a little bit more complete. But, you know, those of us that would want that we're a small minority compared to most people that watch Netflix. They just want to see, you know, an hour and a half and they're done.
Yeah.
So I don't blame Netflix for doing it the way they did.
No, I mean, I knew what it was going to be before I even watched it.
I don't regret watching it, though. I had fun watching it.
Yeah. I mean, I watched it immediately as soon as it was available. I was in a hotel in Minneapolis watching it on my phone. But, you know, it's just funny, like, when Heather Locklear was like, oh, I thought you were a guy from Whitesnake, and it's way too early to be saying Whitesnake. You could pick it apart with stuff like that.
Yeah, but I mean, as far as Dr. Feelgood goes, I remember buying this the day it came out. I remember going to the record store, and I remember all the hype leading up, Metal Edge, Hit Parader, Circus. Yeah. There was so much hype, even months before this came out. While they were recording it, there was hype about it.
Yes.
And I remember buying it that day, and I'll as we go through the track by track, when this was a perfect album from A to Z when I first bought it. I loved every song on it. And in hindsight, it's one of those that it hasn't aged that well. There's the songs that are keepers are still great to me, but there are plenty of songs where in hindsight I'm like, ooh, that didn't age well. But for 1989, I thought it was a fantastic record.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Did you get it on cassette tape?
Yes.
Yeah, me too.
That's how I bought it. That was my playing thing of choice at the time was cassette tapes.
And I think, again, it comes back to the whole reason why I wanted so bad to do Dr. Feelgood with you guys is because it takes me back to that time when you would you know, wait and watch the at the grocery store where the magazines were at and be like, oh, yeah, New Metal Edge, you know, or yeah. New Hit Parade or New Circus, Rip, you know, or something like that. Mm. And you'd get it and, you know, you read it and be like, oh, man, updates from Motley Crue in Vancouver. And, you know, oh, I can't wait, you know, and the excitement and the build and the wait. Nowadays, you don't seem like – it doesn't seem like the kids got to wait for nothing. You know, everything's boom, it's right there. Oh, here's another thing. Boom, it's right there. When we were kids, we had to wait with bated breath and anticipation for something like a new Motley Crue album, you know? And I was into Crue already. You know, I had older cousins that got me Girls, Girls, Girls on vinyl.
That was
you
my
know,
first one.
For Christmas.
That. Yeah.
And so then, you know, I loved it and then discovered the older stuff beyond that. Yep. And then this was like the first new Crue album. Me too. Yeah. And like I said, just the excitement and the waiting and the wanting and, you know, it can't wait to hear when you're talking about it with your friends and, you know, everything you could do to find out a little bit more information about what's – and then when it finally happens, it's an event.
Oh,
you know,
it's a huge event
in your life that you never forget.
I had a watching party for the world premiere of Kickstart My Heart on MTV with like six other friends at my house.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, we couldn't wait to see that video.
Yeah, it's crazy how big of a deal the videos were back then. And I remember Metal Edge would have, at this time, they would have an article where they would go track by track and talk about each song. And that would come out like a month before the record came out. And you would read that. And so you would know all the song titles and descriptions of the songs and everything before the record even came out.
Right, you read that and be like, "Oh, I'm gonna love that song."
And yeah, right. Exactly. <that one. laughs> Yeah.
Oh, magic, magical magic, times. Magical times. God, I miss it.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, so I guess we might as well jump into the track by track. Then I don't really know what's left to talk about for the period leading up this. It's the most boring time for Motley Crue in terms of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, you know.
But the most exciting time for the Motley Crue fans.
So the first track, as Chris already mentioned, it's not even a song. And this is an example of them padding the album. We talked about the Girls, Girls, Girls episode about how they tack Nona and Jailhouse Rock onto the end of each side so they can make it look like it's a full-length album, but it's really just an 8-song record, you know?
Well, they were busy doing cocaine. It was hard to
get
all the songs together.
So this is just an intro to Dr. Feelgood, and there's no reason to give it its own name and track number and everything, but
well, it's no like on Shout at the Devil's got the cool prelude at the beginning, you know, the really cool thing that leads into the tune Shout at the Devil. This one, I mean, it's cool because it's kind of a throwback to that, but it's not nearly as cool as what that was.
Yeah, it's just there to intro the record. I mean, it probably was an afterthought and something that I could see them late in the game on mixing going, we really need something to lead into Dr. Feelgood. And Nikki's like, here, do this. And that was it.
Yeah.
It's interesting, I guess. Almost would have worked better as just like a live intro maybe to have it before they come on stage. But I don't know. I don't hate it, but it's definitely not a song. It's just a piece.
Yeah, it's fine as the intro, but it doesn't need its own name, you know. But I read that like Bob Rock, they were driving an ambulance back and forth, like in the parking lot outside the studio, and Bob Rock was out there with a mic or something. But doesn't this also remind you of Operation Mindcrime? Like it's got a similar vibe to the beginning of Operation Mindcrime.
Yeah, with like the nurse talking, you know, paging her over the intercom. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Terror in Vancouver.
the poor ambulance driver's like, what the fuck are we doing? Why are you miking my ambulance?
We can't do drugs anymore. Don't you get it? This is the only entertaining thing we got.
Yeah.
Keep driving.
Yeah, so that goes into the title track, Dr. Feelgood, which I, like I said, I never really liked this song. The chorus just follows the riff, which I never really... That's the worst kind of a melody, if it just echoes the riff instead of like an interplay with the riff, you know? And there's like no hook there. I've never liked the backing, but like the operatic, like, Dr. Feelgood! You know, I've never liked those vocals, really.
I love that part, especially after the chorus. And then you got the heavy ass riff going underneath it. Yeah. I love that.
That would be the best part of the song when it opens up after the like first part of the chorus. When it opens up into like the more melodic chorus, it gets a little better.
I mean, you like Calling Dr. Love, don't you?
I like it. I can now that I'm older, I can acknowledge that it's really not that good of a song, but I always liked it.
But it's got like similar backing vocals where it's like the high range.
Yeah, yeah.
I love this. There's nothing wrong at all with the song Dr. Feelgood, in my opinion.
No, and there's so many other songs. And the only complaint you can really say about Dr. Feelgood is that after all these years, it's become kind of overplayed.
Oh, yeah.
But well, even still to this day, if you're in the car and you listen to the radio, you ain't got nothing else to listen to but the radio, and you're hearing the normal stuff they play, and Dr. Feelgood comes on, it's good.
It's a good break.
You know, you love it.
Well, is on your, the Chronological Crew website, does it say what the hell Mick Mars is saying after the guitar solo?
No, I don't know.
Dr. Feelgood.
Is that what he's saying?
Yeah.
But he's saying more than that.
He says something else, but then at the end it's come play.
Every time I watch that video, I'm like, what the fuck is he saying?
Maybe he fell off his stool again.
That's the mystery
of
it.
That's the satanic backward lyrics, probably.
Mm. That's the magic of Mick Mars.
But yeah, Mick Mars is the co-writer with Nikki Sixx on this song.
Well, yeah, he came up with that riff. What I read is that the basic riff, when Mick Mars came up with that, he called it Plan 9. That was his name for it. And then Nikki kind of worked with him starting from that and, you know, turned it into this. But don't those background vocals have, like, their own unique sound that isn't on any other song, you know? He's the one that calls Dr. Feelgood. He's the one that makes it feel all right. He's the one that calls Dr. Feelgood. He's gonna be your Frankenstein. Let him soothe your soul, just take his head. Dr. Feelgood. Some people call him an evil man. Dr. Feelgood.
No, I love the song. Love the guitar solo.
Yes.
I love the riff. I love Vince's vocals. I love the lyrics. I love everything about this song. I think it's not their best album opener, but it's up there.
And it was. And again, remembering seeing this, the video for the first time, just the boom, you know, the new crew, and it's the production is massive, you know, and everything, the dun, 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 you know,
it was definitely an event.
the song becomes an event, you know, it's so over the top and huge and heavy and awesome. Oh, I love it. I love it so much. So many good memories.
So the next song, Slice of Your Pie, I wrote, Bob Rock polished the shit out of this turd. It's a polished turd. It sounds really good. It sounds way better than it deserves to sound, because this is not a good song, in my opinion.
This song. This is one of my favorite songs on the album. The thing I love about this song is how, you know, it still kind of captures the, even though, like you say, it's super, super polished, but deep down it's like a sleazy Motley Crue song, you know, and this song kind of keeps them in, it keeps one foot, you know, one foot in Vancouver and one foot in the gutter in Tinseltown, you know what I'm saying? And so it's kind of a throwback to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, yeah, we're big and over the top, and what you just heard, this first track, was this big explosive thing, but deep down we're still dirty, nasty Motley Crue. I love it.
I think you can hear the Aerosmith influence on this song.
I think there's other songs that, like, you can hear it more.
And you gotta wonder, you know, Aerosmith was recording in the same studio, so you gotta wonder if that, some of that rubbed. And I'm sure, you know, all those guys were Aerosmith fans back in the day. But
oh, yeah.
I think it's. I mean, this is one that I wasn't super blown away by back in the day when it came out, because I was all about just glam metal, the new stuff. Didn't really appreciate 70s rock as much at the time. I think this song is more of a throwback to 70s rock, but it's also got the sleazy lyrics on it. You know, I mean,
yeah.
Nobody's going to look at with a straight face at a song called Slice of Your Pie. I mean,
yeah.
And, like, you know, Pizza Hut could have used it for a commercial or something, but it's one of those where that's one song in hindsight that I like more now than I did back then. I like it a lot more now than I used to.
Loved it then, love it now.
But I think it's a cool, sleazy, bluesy riff. You know, it's filler, but it's killer filler.
Yeah.
Well, you know, even on the songs that I don't like on this album, Mick Mars has cool riffs, and the guitar sounds really good. And the best part of this song for me are the riffs that are under the solo section. The riff is at its coolest. Like, it's the basic riff, but it's embellished or added, or there's just more to it, and it's really cool. It's got a good groove. So, and yeah, the guitars sound great. I'm not really into the She's So Heavy ending of the song either, like the Beatles ending that they do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, but it's a tip of the hat to influence, I'm sure, is what that is. But yeah, I never the end of it, I was like, it ends kind of strangely, but it's a good song. I mean, I always liked it.
One thing that's miraculous that Bob Rock seems to have pulled off is he got Vince Neil to somehow double his vocals, I think, on a lot of this, which we were laughing on the Theater of Pain episode because we were talking about how would you ever get Vince. It's hard enough to get one vocal for performance out of Vince without having him then replicate it, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and I think I read a little something about how, you know, especially for Vince Neil, that the recording of Dr. Feelgood was a pretty torturous experience with Bob Rock.
Yeah, like word by word.
yeah, because, like, he'd record, I think I read something that said, like, he'd record for hours and hours and hours, and Bob would be like, yeah, I like these two words in succession here. We'll use that and do the rest. We'll start over again tomorrow.
Yeah, I think a ton of work went into the vocals on this, it sounds like.
And that's wild to think about that, you know, how an album like that is made where it's pieced together, you know. And I know there's more albums out there made this way than I even want to know about.
Yeah.
But how it's like they're pieced together, but then when it's completed, then you give the song back to the band and be like, okay, now learn how to play it like this.
Right.
And then that's what you take out on the road and play at concerts. Mm-hmm. It's not like you came up with this complete song, perfect song, mm-hmm. and just went in and recorded it. It was like created, dissected, recreated, and then represented.
And there was probably more on this album than on anything they had done before.
Oh, totally. Yeah. You know it.
Yeah,
you know
I think Bob Rock probably had a lot to do with arranging this stuff too. Probably had a lot of input.
Yeah, because I think they were more of a scratch track type of band on the albums leading up to this, and it was probably like a complete different education on how to make a record, I'm sure, with him in the studio.
Yeah.
Must have been a real test to their sobriety.
Yeah, they're like, I want to go get 26 vocal takes and you keep two words of it.
Yeah. So the next song, Rattlesnake Shake, is another song that I don't like.
See, this one to me, is the one that sounds like Aerosmith. Like, this song could have been on Permanent Vacation or Pump or something like that. Not like the old classic Aerosmith, but the Aerosmith 80s. That was popular this time. Like, they totally monkeyed a current Aerosmith vibe for this one. When I was a kid, I loved it. As I got older, I was like, kind of a bad Aerosmith ripoff.
I love this song. I think it's a jam. I've liked it. I liked it back then, and I like it now. Just from a musician standpoint, it just seems like a fun song to play.
And, I'm sure.
And Tommy Lee's drum sound on this song is just huge. I mean, I love his drum take on this song, and I could do a little bit without the synth horns that are on the song.
Yeah, see, that's what wrecks it for me.
I think that hurts.
Otherwise,
that hurts the quality of it.
Yeah,
especially at the end where you really hear it's like, okay, we don't need that.
See, that's to me that's what probably ruins it for me.
But the riff itself is great.
Because you say that, and now it's like, well, yeah, this is way better than a lot of the stuff Aerosmith was putting out at this time, in my opinion. So. But yeah, the horns. Motley Crue and a horn section. It's wrong. It's just wrong.
But also, I thought this song, like, you could put this song on Open Up and Say Ah, and it would fit right in too, wouldn't it?
I think so.
Poison couldn't have played this song.
Yeah, I mean, it's better.
Yeah.
It sounds way better than it would have.
Poison couldn't play this song. Give me a break.
Not as well as Motley Crue did.
So the next song, obviously, was like an instant classic, Kickstart My Heart. And
oh, yeah.
I mean, the riff is just irresistible. Mixed guitar sounds great.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I would say about this song that would be negative would be, I think you could do better than Whoa Yeah in your chorus. Like,
yeah,
I think there's a better melody to be had over that riff than Whoa Yeah. So,
possibly, but I mean, when you're writing an anthemic song like this that's supposed to jam and you're playing it for a crowd, what do you want your crowd to yell back at you? Oh, yeah, you know, it's perfect for that.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's a crowd pleaser. Sometimes a band will write a song and, you know, record it thinking of it being a live, in the live set, crowd participation. Yeah, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, this song's perfect for that.
And at the time when it came out, I, along with a lot of other people, were wowed by, you know, the motorcycle sounding guitar intro.
Yeah.
Not realizing at the time that it's a direct lift of Bad Motor Scooter by Montrose, which I had never heard at that point. But, you know, and then the first time I heard Bad Motor Scooter a few years later, I'm like, that's where Mick got the idea for Kickstart My Heart from, because it's the same thing. But I remember that bit. I remember a lot of people like at my school going, wow, listen to the beginning of that song. That guitar sounds like a motorcycle. I mean, everybody was blown away by that.
Oh, it was cool.
Yeah.
One other thing I would say is I do not like the Mayotte. Mayotte! I don't like that part. It annoys me. Because I was thinking about it. It's like...
Everything annoys you,
DJ. Well, there's a lot of singers that they have quirks and they have character to their voice and there's a charm to it. But there's just no charm to Vince Neil. he's not a character. You don't appreciate the character, the guy that's saying, "My hat!" Because it's Vince Neil. I love, like, Joe Strummer, like, the ridiculous way he would pronounce things and stuff. I love that because it's his character and it's the eccentricity of his vocal style or whatever. But there's none of that with Vince Neil. It's just, like, grating to me if he does something like this.
Man, so, I disagree. I think Vince Neil's got a ton of character in his vocals.
Well, at least just not charming. Not a charming character.
I remember the video got played.
Oh,
extreme.
Yeah.
But I always liked the video with, you know, all the skydiving and stuff and, you know, all the extreme stuff going on mixed in with them playing at the whiskey. I mean, it was the right video for the right time. And I remember the world premiere. Like I said, I had a bunch of friends come over and watch it at my house and, you know, seeing Sam Kennison on the beginning of the video. You know, Sam's driving the car that drives them up to the whiskey and they all get out. And it's just the way time works when you're a kid to where it works now, you know, is so different because, you know, the 90s were, you know, 20 years ago. But like when you look at this video, it's like their triumphant return to where they came from. But it's really like 8 years later. So it's like, you know, in the me of my 40s, it's like, it wasn't that long. But when I'm 12, like, wow, they came back 8 years later.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. So the next song, Without You.
Oh, man. Hated it then, hate it now.
Oh, it's just emblematic of everything that was wrong with this kind of power ballad that just was devoid of any like actual emotion, just completely generic and contrived and just, ugh.
I do like Mick's little slide guitar part on it.
That's pretty cool.
But it's like it for some reason, like a lot of other bands could pull off. Motley did with Home Sweet Home. That was genuine, but
yeah,
for some reason on Dr. Feelgood, like, and then they put a video out for it and it's just like, it didn't come off believable. It was just like this, you could feel that it was a cash grab from the second they put it out.
That's right. Just three songs ago, you're singing about a slice of pie.
Yeah.
And now you expect me to believe that you guys have hearts and you know, have special place in love, you know, and give me a break. I don't believe it for a second.
I used to,
but you know what? The ladies believed it.
Yeah, I don't. Did this chart very well? I don't know.
Yeah, this was a top 10 hit, which I was surprised by. Yeah,
I don't remember this being a hit.
The freaking cassette, the single probably outsold more than anything that sells
probably
today.
So. It was probably a lot of couple songs, but yeah. I remember
wedding songs. I bet for really cool people.
I used to videotape MTV all the time. Like if they would have, you know, obviously Headbangers Ball, I would record every Saturday night. But if they were, you know, MTV used to do news segments with a lot of the hair metal bands.
Yeah.
And I remember they were hyping this all damn week. We're on the set of the new Motley Crue video. We're going to have an exclusive, you know, behind the scenes peek of what they're doing and everything. And everybody, and me and a bunch of my friends that were Motley Crue fans got all excited for it. And I'm like at home with my VHS tape ready to go. And I record this thing and it's for Without You.
Yeah.
And I'm watching like boulders almost hit Mick and stuff and like all this.
Yeah,
really
I think I remember life. That. Yeah.
And I remember watching it going, well, that was weird. And yeah, we kind of just stopped talking about it at that point. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a bad song, but like I said, it's not. It doesn't come off genuine from them. It just comes off like, you know, everybody else is doing it, so we have to do a power ballad.
Do it too, you know, and it's going to make us a shit ton of money, and the girls are going to love it. And that's exactly what it did. I guess you can't fault them for it because they all did it, and it did exactly what they wanted it to do. But,
yeah, this is one of those songs that has not aged well.
But no, I never liked it, and as like as a Motley Crue fan, I like the heavy stuff. I like Dr. Feelgood. I like Kickstart My Heart. I don't like Without You.
Yeah,
I think if you wanted to explain what was wrong with this song, you could just play Home Sweet Home and say, see, it's missing everything that's good about this.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, it, just Home Sweet Home, you felt like they meant
it
what
was
they
real.
Were doing.
Yeah, that there was a story about something that they experienced that was real.
Without You feels like the record company going, you need a ballad.
Yeah. Look what Bon Jovi's doing. Yeah. Give us some of that action.
Aerosmith, Angel.
Yeah, you know, totally. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. They were falling in line with that song.
All it's missing is Desmond Child, right?
It sounds like a song he would have worked
totally
on.
It totally does, yeah.
Not that I'd have nothing against Desmond Child. No. I love him.
But, and nothing against ballads, per se. This is just a really bad example of it.
It sounds half-assed.
Well, that's why I don't like ballads, because most of them, that's the case. You know, from the bands that I like from that era, 9 times out of 10, that was the case. Hey, we're a kick-ass heavy rock band, but whoa, look what Bon Jovi. Let's make some Bon Jovi money, huh?
Although they could go the route they did on Girls, 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 where the ballad is about a guy killing his girlfriend.
See, that I can accept.
You know that when they wrote Home Sweet Home, they didn't sit down and say, okay, we need a ballad for the album, and then they wrote Home Sweet Home. Home Sweet Home was, you know, wasn't like that. But you know, as soon as you hear this song, you know that's exactly what this is we need a ballad to plug into this spot on the record and release as the second single or whatever. It's just to fill a role, you know.
And totally even though I love Mick's guitar part, he looks very unamused in the video.
I have no love in my heart, with or without you.
One thing I noticed is it sounds, there's parts where it sounds like Vince is saying without chew. And I was thinking that it would be hilarious to edit together like a video of Han Solo, like separated from Chewbacca. And it's like a bell, like without chew. He was like when he got captured by Jabba the Hutt, right? He was probably separated from Chewbacca then, and
really thought this through.
Without you, Wookiee. It even rhymes with "The World Comes Down on Me." Oh, that's another thing. It says in this song, "The world comes down on him," and then a couple songs later, she's going down on him and all his friends. It's like a very, very different sentiment.
I just think this whole song needs to be frozen in carbonite.
Chewie. Chewie, is that you? Chewie! Can't see, pal. What's going on?
So I guess that was the last song on side one, huh? And then same old situation is the first song on side two.
I like same old situation. I think I liked it better then than I do now, though.
Hasn't aged well.
I think it's a fun song. It's my second favorite song on the album, personally.
Really?
Yeah. But it is, you know, it's just like one of those like pop metal, almost a hair metal type sing-along song. You know, it's not, it does have a lot of artistic merit to it, but it's...
It's one of those that got shoved down our throat so much on MTV that I got so burned out on this song. Because this video got played so
Oh, yeah.
Fun.
Yeah, there was probably a time where I was totally sick of this, but I think long enough has passed where I hadn't really listened to it much that I can appreciate it again
it's
now.
It's a pop rock song. I mean, and the fact that they used it as a video of them live, I thought that was a smart move because, you know, they had done other stuff before that. But, I mean, for the time, for 1989, it was the right song at the right time. But it's just because I'm burned out. I still appreciate it for what it is, but I rarely ever pull that one out to listen to.
No. And it's a song about losing your woman to a woman, right?
Yeah, that's kind of cool. unless you're the guy.
Unless it's happening to you. It's cool. So it's almost cool if you get to see it happen to somebody else,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah, pretty much. I remember it being kind of thought-provoking for my middle school crowd.
Sure, yeah.
You know, everybody's like, oh, my God, you hear what he's singing about?
That can happen? Yeah. Oh, my God.
But, no, I mean, it's a fun pop rock song. It's up tempo.
Yeah,
know, it gets you moving. Nothing it wrong.
Reminds
wrong with
me
it.
Of like a Poison tune.
Yeah, it does.
Not bad. So that's your second favorite. What's your first favorite on the record? Have we gotten to it yet?
No, we didn't get to it yet.
Time for change, right?
Of course it is. It's BJ Kahuna we're talking to.
Yeah, it's funny that you guys are kind of down on Seamless Situation. That's
I'm not down on it. It's one of those that I don't really look as finely back on as I used to, I guess.
Yeah.
And I think that's more a case of being burned out on it, I think.
And I don't necessarily hate it, but it would be, if I was ranking these songs, it would be in the bottom half for sure.
Yeah.
I don't think it'd be in the bottom half, but I just don't have a lot to say about it. It got played just to the umpteenth degree back then.
It is totally dated, but it's and it's not. I mean, when am I going to go listen to this song? I was looking at, I mean, if I look at a bunch of the records that came out right around this same time that I love so much more than this album, like Long Cold Winter, Blow My Fuse, Great Radio Controversy. You know, I love those records way more than this. Even the first Skid Row and Cocked and Loaded. And Boys in Heat came out right around this time, which I love that record, the second Britney Fox. So I would go listen to any of those records before I'd ever go listen to this album anyways. But
this is the only song on the record where all four members are credited as writers.
Right. I wonder why that is. Oh yeah. And yeah, looking at this, Bob Rock is not credited on any of these songs as a writer. That's weird.
This song does have some good cowbell in the middle of it.
Yeah, that's true. That is true.
Now the next one.
Oh man. Yeah, Sticky Sweet is really awful.
What?
I hate this song.
What?
I've never liked this.
This
I
is my favorite song on the whole album. My favorite song. It's always been my
this
favorite
shows,
song.
This shows why our show works, because you and I are just
opposite
on stuff.
Oh, man. I love the way Vince sings. I love the groove of the song. I love Mick Mars playing. Tommy Lee rules this whole album, so I don't even need to say that. But, I mean, yeah, this song is badass.
Bad.
Back when I was a young man, I was a DJ at a strip club. I used to love to play this song and watch girls dance to it.
Well, that's a different motivation. I mean, I get using it in a strip club.
And it's an awesome, just dripping with sexiness, Motley Crue rock tune. I love it.
I think it's a throwaway.
No.
I've never liked this song.
No.
It is bad. But it is true that Mick has some cool riffs and the guitar sounds good. But
yeah, real good.
You need more than that to make a good song. So,
I think this is some of Vince's best singing on the album, too, is on this song. I think you guys are wrong. You might have to go back
it
and
doesn't have
it.
There's just not much in the hooks department.
No, it's not a good song.
It's there. It doesn't do much.
It grinds and it grooves and it's slippery and, oh, I love it.
Put that thing away. I'm glad it's an audio talk.
I'll take that clip and put it over the part of Tommy and Pam's video. Put it up on YouTube.
Hey, wait a minute.
So that's not your favorite song, huh, BJ?
Sticky Sweet, no. That's one of the worst. It's in the bottom two or three for sure.
It's in the bottom two for me.
Yeah. Even the next song is not necessarily saved by having Robin Zander and Rick Nielsen singing background vocals on it. Goes down. This Now, there's some really cool riffs in this song. I will say that. You know, Mick Mars, Tom Werman. I talked to Tom Werman, and he was talking about how great Mick Mars was and how he thinks he's really underrated and how he just loved the riffs that he would play and, the guitar licks. And, yeah, so there's some really cool stuff in She Goes Down that Mick does, but doesn't really save it from just being a pretty basic dumb song to me.
I love this one.
I do too.
And this one has all the hooks that Sticky Sweet doesn't have. I think this one is a great rocker. It's killer filler. It's certainly not single material. You're never going to hear that on the radio, but it's a great album track. Yes, it's a stupid song, but that's what's great about it.
Yeah. It has good elements. It's really repetitive though.
Yeah, but for that period, I mean, as a middle schooler, I mean, it was a funny song because the lyrics are so boneheaded, but and all the talk about the different places that they go and all the different women in different places. And of course everybody here was like, oh wow, he said Tennessee, everybody was excited about that. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly, it would get a hell of a lot of hate if it got released today in these times.
But, oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely, it's not coming from the Me Too movement side of things. It's sleazy, bigoted, and stupid, but it's also a lot of fun.
See, and I think, I know I love this song. I love this song a lot. I loved it when I was young, junior. It was the perfect thing to stimulate my junior high mind and my blowers, too, but
I told you, put it away.
Can't help it when I'm talking about these songs, But I think about that, too, I think I had the sex talk with Motley Crue before I ever had it with my parents.
A lot of us did.
Motley Crue and Kiss taught me everything.
That's what the PMRC was afraid of.
Well, they knew their target audience. They really did. So songs like this would get all of us 13-year-olds and excited about stuff like that.
Stuff that can really happen. And that's why you looked at guys when you were that age. I know I did. As your heroes, these guys are living it. They're getting laid all the time. They got beautiful women around them. I mean, Heather Locklear, and they're out there getting paid millions and millions of dollars to play these rock and roll songs. That's the dream, man. Mm-hmm. And at that age, when you're so influential like that, and you're seeing these videos on MTV, and you're seeing the girls and hearing songs like She Goes Down, it gives you hope for the future. Someday I'm going to grow up, I'm going to be a man, and somebody might go down on me. It's going to be awesome. I can't wait for that to happen.
You and all your friends.
We're all getting blowjobs someday.
But I also say Bob Rock's production helps take the song to a different level. Because, I mean, this song could have been on Girls, Girls, Girls easily, but without the great production with Tommy's drums sounding like they are and with the great gang vocals on the song, it helped take it to a better level than what it probably – the demo probably isn't that impressive, but with Bob Rock's production on top of it, it makes it a cool song to me.
One of my favorite things about this song is the way it breaks down and is like, and then Vince drops his voice a little bit, flat on her back, they get in that, and then it picks back up. She gives a heart attack. Boom, boom.
Yeah, I love breakdowns in songs where they build back up. I think that's a cool thing to do.
She goes down with all of my friends. She goes down. She gives heart attack. She goes. She goes down. She goes down. She goes down, 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 down. She goes down. She goes down, down, down.
The next song is my favorite song on the album.
Going to be the case.
Yeah, and this Don't Go Away Mad is everything that Without You is not, right? It's, I mean, to me, it's just really great songwriting, great melodies, and the production is, just great. So I love this song. I think the melodies are amazing. The whole song the way it's arranged, everything about it, it's just so well done. And probably a lot of credit goes to Bob Rock for how great this turned out, but it's a really great song too. It's really well written as well.
Aaron?
It's all right, I guess. It's not the greatest song on the album by far, but I mean, you're right. You know, it is everything that Without You isn't. You know, this harkens back to more of a Home Sweet Home kind of a song, because this seems more legit and less forced
than totally.
The other ballad. And, you know, it's clever. The lyrics are cool. Vince's delivery's pretty kick-ass on it.
I think it's his best performance.
Again, Mick Mars, Tommy Lee, they're on top of it. They are the whole album. I'll say that about every single song we talk about.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's, again, too, here's another thing that may be overlooked a little bit, and it's Nikki Sixx songwriting.
Yeah.
You know, there's some really cool, clever stuff going on in the lyrics on this album where, I mean, Nikki Sixx was always a good songwriter, but I think on this album, the depth gets a little bit more. And I think that's probably got to do with a lot to do with, you know, him sobering up for this and then having some introspective, retrospective moments and then really focusing those feelings and emotions into these lyrics, you know, and coming up with some really, really cool stuff.
This may be the deepest Motley Crue song ever written. I mean,
it's
very out of character for a Motley Crue song. It's basically about helping your friends through a breakup and you know, but like it's Nikki Sixx really stretching his abilities, and it's the closest they ever came to a true crossover hit where it would go into different genres, because I could hear people of multiple genres doing covers of this song because it's just that well written of a song.
This could be the number one country song next week.
Yeah, it could be a huge country song. But it's, you know, I don't think I appreciated it as much back in the day because I wanted the harder stuff.
Right.
But, you know, as I matured and my taste in music matured and you listen to it now, it's like, damn, it's a damn well-written song.
It's cool because it's like a story song.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of, you know, it's like one of those Johnny Cash tunes where it's like, it's not just a song, it's a story within a song, you know, and it's like, you listen to it and it's like, okay, you know, it's one of them songs that can make a video in your head, you know, you don't need to see a video because it's so well spoken and understandable, and it tells that story that you can almost imagine a little movie inside your head. I remember being a little kid with the headphones on, lights out, eyes closed, listening to stuff like this and just imagining, you know, wow, what it must be like to be Motley Crue. You know, they're out in LA and this is happening, and wow, that's going on, and oh, they wrote this song about this, you know, and your imagination, you know. Again, you know, I wish I could go back to this day. I wish there was something they put in a bottle or you could roll up into a paper that you could smoke that would give you back the feelings you had when you were in junior high.
Yeah,
you know, the things that were so special, you know, that you look back now that were so simple.
Yeah.
You know, but it makes you who you are, you know. And I think I'm just so grateful that I grew up when I did.
Me too.
You know, in this era when albums like this were coming out, when you could get excited about music and have favorite bands. And, you know, I was talking about my kid the other day, and, you know, I was talking to the wife, and I said, as stupid as this sounds, you know, when I was 18, if you would have came to me and said, you know, what do you care about? What are you passionate about? I'd have said, rock and roll.
Yeah.
And, you know, as goofy as that sounds, but, you know, it led me on a path to where we get to do the Decibel Geek podcast. And today, that's one of my biggest passions. And it all comes from bands like Motley Crue and Kiss and Ozzy and, you know, the bands that warped me as a young kid, you know, to make me into the person that I am. And, you know, I just got to say thank you to those bands and that time. And, you know, so grateful that, you know, we got to live it.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, well said. But who would have expected this song to show up on this record? It's like comes out of nowhere, and it's not stuck in any genre. It's just kind of a timeless rock song. But like I think Nikki described it as kind of a Rod Stewart type song, which you could kind of hear like the Maggie May kind of vibe to it.
Yeah, I can hear that. Or like an old Faces tune. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't sound like really Boy, that's the closest thing, because it really doesn't sound like anything of their contemporaries. No. You know, it's definitely not Poison, Aerosmith, anything like that.
It broke what was going on at the time.
It wasn't even Motley Crue.
But it's funny that it charted pretty well, didn't it?
I'm not sure. I mean, I remember the video. All I could think about is Tommy and Nikki walking around with their sides of their heads shaved with the hair in a ponytail.
That was a huge subject of discussion at school.
Yeah. But I think this song is the kind of song where a lot of people there's probably a lot of people out there who would like this song who have never heard it and would never think they would like a Motley Crue song.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's a great song.
Yeah, you guys are making me rethink it, too. The more I reminisce on it, the more I know I like it. I know I do.
Although, like I said, MTV almost ruined it for me because they rammed it down our throats.
Yeah.
It was this video. I think this got more airplay than any of the other videos from the album.
Yeah, I just watched too much Headbangers Ball every week. Actually, me and my friend used to, every week we would each pick 10 songs and see who got the most right for what they were going to play on Headbangers Ball, because they would just play the same stuff every week, you know? So we would always have our lists of 10 and then, you know, be fun to check them off and see who got the most.
I guess MTV must have really saw something in that song too then that was different.
They played the shit out of
special,
that song.
So they pushed it so hard.
Yeah, it was on all the time. It felt like it was on every hour for a while there.
Yeah, I remember it being on the radio too. The radio in Milwaukee would kind of pick certain songs that they really liked. It seems like, you know, I think that was back when radio DJs had more choice over what they played. And so, you know, they would play stuff they liked as opposed to just stuff that they were trying to push or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's totally true.
Like, it was famous in Milwaukee that Tesla were really... Like, before they hit it big, they were huge in Milwaukee because the radio station played all kinds of... They played Changes and Getting Better and just, like, constantly. Like, they really pushed that because they liked it so much. And then, so they were really big in Milwaukee.
Right. You don't really get that too much anymore. No. You know, where that used to be a thing. Like, you talk about a band that would be huge in, you know, Canada and also in Texas, you know?
Yeah.
That's because the same handful of... companies own all of the radio stations now, right? So there is no regional rock anymore. Nope. It's all nationwide,
and they're all playing what they're told to play.
Yep. But anyway, radio sucks. We know that.
Yeah.
Except for Lonnie.
Yeah. Yeah, don't you guys do a series about how radio sucks?
Yeah,
we should. That's a great idea.
Fantastic.
Thanks, BJ. We gotta try that out.
Now, you know, they had the perfect ending to this album, like just a magnificent closer. Like, this is where you end the record, right? And they had Terror in Tinseltown, so they could even pretend it was a 10-song album. Right. But they had to have another song on here, didn't they?
I'd like to pretend it was a 10-song album.
Well, they had to have their We Are the World.
Oh, God. Yeah, this is the worst song on the record, right? Are we unanimous that Time for Change is the worst song on here?
Without question.
Yeah, it's just the most contrived thing probably that they ever did, where it was just like, I don't know, who thought this was a good idea? Like, who thought this was going to go over well with their fans? Because it didn't. know anyone who loves this song.
I'll tell you what, that's not true, because when I was in junior high, we went to some sort of, I don't know if it was like a talent show slash pep rally kind of thing, and I think the drama class
did
some kind of lip sync skit sort of thing, maybe about recycling or something.
Oh, brother.
But they did it to this song. I just remember the weird, weird girl like out spinning around in like amongst us, like off the stage, and waving her arms around in lip sync. I think she may have actually been singing into the mic, singing this song.
Wow.
And it's like, what is this?
You know, we're wrong. Congrats, Motley Crue. You made it happen.
Yeah, you, hey, wait a minute. There's something missing on this album. There's nothing for the weird kids. We got something for the ladies. We got plenty for the dudes. We got this one here for, you know, just this weird song that's different than everything else. We're missing something for the weird fans.
I still don't know what the hell the song's about. What exactly are they changing?
It's time for change.
It's about how nothing stays the same.
Nothing stays the same, Chris. Don't you know that?
That's the most
it's time.
What a meta.
Yeah.
It's a real mind fuck,
hey,
man.
Hey, Nikki, what needs to change? I don't know, but it needs to change.
That's up to the listener to figure out. You know, you listen to that song, and then you look within, and you will find the answer.
It's like,
and the answer is this song sucks.
It's like Tony Robbins joined Motley Crue. It's
very
confused. It's like a motivational metal song.
Yeah. How perfect was Don't Go Away Mad as the last song on the record? I mean, it was perfect. But I think...
I don't know what they...
I think this song is the Send Me an Angel. The idea is, if Without You is like a number one hit for 10 weeks straight, we need another ballad to come out with to... Oh. You know, have to keep that train rolling.
The balladry.
You know, like when Winds of Change was huge, then they had Send Me an Angel to put out, you know.
Yeah.
I hate those songs, too. I like
those. So that's kind of what I think is, it's like we need a backup so that we could capitalize even more. Like if Without You is just one of those huge smash ballads, then we've got another one. You know, to keep that money train rolling.
So we should be thankful that Without You bombed. Or no, it didn't bomb.
It
no.
didn't bomb, but I guess it wasn't big enough to have to say, we now we'll put out Time for Change, you know.
Can you imagine what would have happened if they'd put this out as a single?
Yeah, the video.
Like, you must get to that point where you've been off drugs for so long.
Yeah, now it's time to get back on them.
You get, exactly. It says, look. Look what we accomplished not being on drugs. You know, now listen to this. Can we please start doing drugs again now? Yeah. You know, done with the album. Listen to this song. Yes, go do drugs.
Maybe
again.
They started doing drugs after Don't Go Away Mad, and that's the reason for this song, because they must have been high on something.
This is some sort of relapse of some kind.
Of reason.
A relapse of reason.
I'm curious if you're going to have any listeners defend this song.
I can't imagine it. One thing I didn't look up with is who the hell Donna McDaniel is.
I saw that on the liner notes, and I'm like, who is this? I don't even know who that is.
I don't know. I should have tried to find out.
Nikki and somebody named Donna McDaniel wrote it.
It sounds to me like it was written at an AA meeting. I mean, nothing against that, but it's just kind of one of those... Like you say, it's supposed to be like some kind of inspiration. We don't need no inspiration from Motley Crue.
We don't need no inspiration.
The only inspiration I ever needed from Motley Crue was the idea that someday I might get a girl to kiss me down there. That was it.
I'm trying to look up
Donna McDaniel was in the film Hollywood Hot Tubs and performed many songs on the soundtrack for Hollywood Hot Tubs.
Hollywood Hot Tubs now is it all my makes favorite sense. Movie.
Yeah, it all makes sense now.
I don't know what that is, but I'd like to see it, I think.
I can imagine what it is. She 1984?
She was a background singer for the crew.
Oh, okay.
That's because she's on IMDb, too. Okay.
Change, now it's time to change. Nothing stays the same. I change, and you hit the ground running. Change, now it's time to change. Kevin Stacey say? Chain. Yeah, you hit the ground running.
It would have been fine. It would have looked like there were 10 songs, and Don't Go Away Mad just ends the album perfectly, and everything would have been good. Just completely leave this off. But
there were probably a lot of dubbed copies of this where Don't Go Away Mad was the last song.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not my iPod, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. What a way to go out.
But most of the rest of the album is.
Oh, man.
It's a bummer ending to an amazing, awesome album.
Yeah. Yeah. Just leave that off in Sticky Sweet and be all good.
What? Sticky Sweet should have been the lead single.
Oh, boy. That's why you don't run a record company.
I'm just kidding about that.
We did this one. Are you doing Decade of Decadence, or are you skipping right over to 94 after this?
Well, I was talking to Ian and Ralph about doing something for Decade of Decadence, but I don't know if it's going to happen.
Yeah.
I did want to like talk about Primal Scream and stuff, but...
Sure. And Don't Go Away Mad Part 2, which is called Angela.
Yeah.
It's the same music.
Actually, I just wrote to John Lamoureux today because he interviewed Bob Rock, and I thought maybe I could just talk to Bob Rock like just about Primal Scream, but John said it doesn't sound... He doesn't feel comfortable giving me the publicist email or so, and he doesn't think Bob Rock would do it. But
should get Bob Rock to talk about this record. I think that'd be cool to hear.
Yeah.
Well, Primal Scream's a really interesting song. Like the way it's put together and how different it is and everything. I would like to hear, you know, what he remembers about putting that thing together. That's totally like a studio creation, you know.
Yeah. That's one of my favorite Motley Crue songs.
Yeah, totally.
It's a great song. It's really different too.
Sounds like it could have fit on Dr. Feelgood, though. Like it fits right in.
It should have been on Dr. Feelgood.
They probably didn't have it yet, did they?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
But when I hear it, it sounds like it would have fit right in on it.
Yeah, they could have knocked off that last song, just waited a little while and put that on instead.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't end up doing anything for Decade of Decadence, I'll keep that in.
Okay. Here's 2 minutes on Decade of Decadence.
That was another one, too. I was excited about it.
Yeah, I bought that on release day,
yeah,
too.
Totally.
Yep.
Yeah. 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 Well, they were pushing Primal Scream on Headbangers Ball and MTV before it came out, probably. I'm sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They always did that.
And so that... That would have, yeah. I think I went and bought that right away when it came out too.
Oh no, I did. Yep.
Good stuff, man. Good stuff. Good times.
Thanks for letting us do this with you.
Yeah,
it's been fun to talk about.
Yeah, thank you guys for doing this and this Motley Crue series is going on for a while, but.
It's awesome, man.
I put up a poll on my Facebook page and. Twice as many people said they want more Motley Crue than they want less Motley Crue. So,
oh sure, they're a fun band to talk about.
good, smart people with great taste in music. That's what you get when you listen to Rock and or Roll.
Ago, there was a meeting at rehearsal. Vince Neil came in and said, guys, I don't think I want to be in the crew anymore. And the crew said, guys, I don't think we want you in the band anymore. This is deep. Now let me tell you a little bit about what happened. According to this press release that Elektra Records put out just yesterday, the crew's relationship with Neil began to deteriorate because his bandmates felt he didn't share their determination and passion for music. Neil was the only crew member who didn't regularly participate in the songwriting process. That's true. The songwriting does come from Nikki Sixx and Mick Mars. And as of late, Vince Neil's been falling off the wagon, as it were. This is a sober band. This is something that Nikki believed in, and that has taken away from his studio seriousness. They've been rehearsing the new material for a record, which is coming out in 93 with Bob Rock as producer. And because there's been this lack of energy, things are just falling apart, and as of yesterday, it's over. Vince Neil has to find a new gig. As far as Motley Crue goes, remember Van Halen? What happened when Roth left? Sammy Hagar. What happened to Black Sabbath when Ozzy left? What happened with AC/DC when Bon Scott passed away? The great bands go on. They are auditioning new singers. He's going to be young, he's going to be arrogant, and the crew will live. Trust me.
We've got singer Vince Neil on the phone, ready to talk about being kicked out of Motley Crue. As you may recall, Motley Crue announced last week that it had parted company with its lead singer Vince Neil after 11 years and 6 albums together. The reason the band gave for this unexpected split was that, quote, race car driving has become a priority in Neil's life, and that because of this, the rest of the group felt that Neil, quote, did not share their determination and passion for music. Once upon a time, the members of Motley Crue felt somewhat different about each other, as they made clear in an interview we did with them back in May of 1990.
And talk about four opposite type of people. You know, you couldn't plan for more different type of people. And it's hilarious, you know. 10 years later, we're like this.
I couldn't even imagine playing with somebody else. You know, I'd rather just call it quits.
If the day ever comes we stop making albums, yeah, you'll be able to, like, run into us all in the corner somewhere when we're 90 and we'll all still be hanging out together. Mick will be 95.
Vince Neil's sudden parting of the ways with his Motley Crue bandmate leaves Elektra Records, the group's label, with an interesting situation on its hands, having, as it did, recently re-signed Motley Crue to a multi-album recording deal rumored to be worth as much as $35 million. To find out what Neil's departure means to this deal and what the real reasons behind the breakup are, we've got Vince Neil on the telephone right now. Let's see what he has to say. Are you there, Vince?
Yeah, sure. I'm here, Kurt.
Is this pretty much true, what they're saying, that you just developed a sudden passion for auto racing and lost it for music, or what's really going on there?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely wrong. I've been involved in racing for like the last 7 years, and it's been a hobby of mine. And just like, you know, everybody has hobbies, but I did not leave Motley Crue. I was fired, and music has always been the number one thing in my life, and that's all there's ever been.
Was this a sudden thing, this firing, or was it something that's sort of long time brewing?
It happened like out of the blue. I mean, we were rehearsing, writing new songs for the album, and it just came as a complete shock to me. The one thing is that I really didn't like the way the music was heading into. Maybe I didn't have the enthusiasm for the new music, but, I don't think it was a reason to be fired over it. Anytime I wanted to say something about the music, I was always just shut down right away. I guess they just thought that it was time to go on and look for a new singer.
What is this? This seems like it would mean something pretty serious for this record deal. This re-signing you just did with Elektra, is it going to queer that whole deal, or what do you think?
Yeah, you know what? I really don't know. I really have no idea. I know that that Motley Crue will go on. As I've heard it now, they're auditioning new singers, mm-hmm. and so I don't know where it is legally, but contractually, I think that if they just go on as Motley Crue, they'll still be Elektra will still honor the contract. But I really don't know.
What are you going to do yourself? Have you planned that yet?
Yeah, actually, I'm really jazzed about starting a solo career, mm-hmm. and all my buddies from all kinds of other bands, are like, hey, dude, man, want to play on your record, and it's just great. I think things happen for a reason, and I think just this might be just like the best thing right now for both of us. I feel really sorry, really sad for the fans, because Motley Crue, I think, was one of the greatest bands there ever was, and it's really sad to not be part of it anymore. But it really wasn't my decision.
Okay. Well, you say they were doing the kind of music that you sort of didn't like. They're not trying to do a Paul Abdul record or anything.
Well,
like that.
It was getting close. Let's put it that way.
Something to look forward to. Okay. Thanks for joining us here and explaining that, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Crue about Vince Neil's departure from the band, but so far all interview requests have been denied. Ooh.
Be back.